Ross an alcoholic. All right, finally made it here. Oh yes, my mask, thank you. So I was asked 2019 to speak at the 2021 conference, and then for understandably reason, you know, we didn't have it. But I got to tell you, I would have put on a spacesuit and canoed across the Gulf of Mexico to get here, because I would have done that for a drink too, right? Willing to go to any length. And in fact, you know, I recall, so I first got sober in Tampa, and this brings to mind a story of there was a hurricane coming through town, but I had a responsibility to run this meeting. So, you know, willing to go to any length, I showed up at that meeting during the hurricane. It was quite a journey to get there, and I sat there, and I made the coffee, and I'm sitting in the room, and nobody's showing up, and I'm like, and then I thought about my sponsor. I'm like, that son of a gun. So I called him, and I said, man, what happened to, you know, willing to go to any length? You would have gone, you know, in a hurricane to go to the liquor store, right? And he says, yes, Russ, but we were insane then. And I was like, oh, yes. Okay, so I had a little meeting by myself and went home. Learned a lesson there. But really, really happy to be here. You know, a lot of thanks to the committee this weekend, and I think at the end of this event here soon, that definitely is worth another thank you to the volunteers and the committee. Thank you so much. Been absolutely amazing, much better than I even expected. Wonderful, wonderful. Margo picking my brother and I up at the airport, so she couldn't hold up her sign, and the airport was very crowded, but she picked us out. She has an eye for the alcoholic, I think. Sure not an Al-Anon? I think I heard Barbara's story last night that the Al-Anons have an eye for the alcoholics or something like that. So, but I think maybe the eye for the sober alcoholics. But really appreciate that, and so here we are. My sobriety date is December 9th, 2007. My sponsor is Gene Luker. Gene is based in Tampa. I've had a few sponsors in my drinking and sober career that I'll share a little bit on. My home group is To Improve Our Conscious Contact. Now, we meet Saturday nights in Tampa. It's a 11-step meeting. We have a speaker speak on step 11, and then we do a little bit of meditation, a little bit different every night. We really stretch the autonomy thing in this group, explore all kinds of different types of stuff. And as mentioned, I recently moved south from Tampa. So I'm now in the Venice Beach, Inglewood area in South Florida. Somebody's clapping. Yes. So searching for a group down there, maybe I'll just start a big book study or something. Yeah, I'm a big fan of big book studies, so searching for one of those. You know, I loved drinking before I picked up my first drink. I was absolutely infatuated with it. And I recall this. I remember this because I look back to when I was a kid. I grew up north of the Tampa area, Lutz, kind of wooded back then, country. This was, showing my age, 70s. And, you know, I'm talking 8, 9, 10 years old. And I recall my brother and I, my brother, by the way, who is here with me at this conference, totally cool. My brother and I playing cowboys. We were big fans of playing cowboys. But unlike other kids with pop guns and stuff like that in the backyard playing cowboys, I recall we were playing barroom. I'm talking about 8, 9, 10 years old. We're setting up a bar on the back porch. We got our cowboy hats on. We got shot glasses. We got we have a jug of apple juice because it kind of looked like that stuff they drink on TV, and we're slamming shots of apple juice and falling around the back porch. You would think our parents probably would have noticed, you know, red flag or something. And in fact, we played Rob the Bank a lot too. kind of starting to make sense. So I had this infatuation early on with drinking, and I kind of, you know, wonder where I got that from. Now, a little bit from my family. My family, active alcoholics, big time. My grandmother would carry a little pint of vodka with her all the time. She called it her medicine. She seemed to be sick all the time. A little bottle of medicine. But really, our immediate family, our parents didn't drink that much. My dad, I think, maybe one or two beers a day. And sometimes, you know, get up late at night and they're out drinking a little bit more, but we weren't exposed to it too much. But for me, it was TV. I think I just saw it on TV a lot. And the Westerns. Obviously, we were infatuated with the Westerns, and I was a big Westerns fan. Anybody, any Westerns fans here? Okay, awesome. And of course, I don't know about you, but my favorite scene in the Westerns was the barroom scene. And here's how I remember it, too. So that cowboy, he would walk to the doors of the barroom, and he'd push open those squeaky doors, and he'd walk in, and it's dark, hardwood floors, he's alone, there's nobody else there, just the bartender over cleaning some glasses, shot glasses, some heads are shaking. That is okay. I didn't know if that was just my perception of what was happening. And the guy, he was angry, he was alone, he looked tired, his head was kind of down, and he walked over to that bar, and he said, "Give me a good one." And he'd slide over that shot glass of that beautiful golden liquid, and he'd take that shot and just, I see heads bobbing to that thing. We love that right? I came to chase that for a long time. And his shoulders would go down a little bit, and he'd relax. He'd say, "Give me another one." And he'd take that shot, and he'd start to smile and perk up a little bit. "Give me another one." And he'd take that shot, and next thing you know, there's people dancing, and some guy's playing the piano, and he'd take another shot, and the room's crowded, and he's smiling. He'd take another shot, the ladies start coming downstairs, and it was like every shot it got better. Now, that's what it was like, right? Of course, I'm asking alcoholics. that was my perception. But it just, you know, the cowboy scenes and really anything that I saw, I noticed that people, when they drank, they got happier. And I was not happy. I was a young kid, and I was screwed up inside. And I was just so incredibly uncomfortable with myself, extremely introverted, always in my head, concerned about what people thought of me. I didn't want to talk. I didn't want to do anything. I didn't have friends in school. I was just extremely uncomfortable. And now, you know, I'm talking 8, 9, 10 years old. And so I saw that, and I saw that change, and I knew there was something in that. So I had my first experience with it. I was camping out in my backyard with a friend and two girls. He brought two girls, which I wasn't happy about. I mean, I like girls, but I was so nervous. I'm like, "Great, I can't talk. I'm going to be frozen." And that's how it was. We're sitting in the tent. I'm like, scared to death because there were ladies there. And that was like doubled my introversion on that when the ladies were around. But he's like, "Russ, you got to loosen up, man. Why don't you get your dad's bottle of whiskey on top of the refrigerator?" And I was like, "Yo, there is a bottle of whiskey up there." So I went and I got that bottle, and we brought it into the tent. I took a couple swigs on that thing, and the eye hit me. And I had my first spiritual awakening about two swigs in. My first release and relaxation. And then they couldn't shut me up. talking away, and we ran around the neighborhood having fun. And you know, it was my first spiritual experience. You know, I recall, so Bill W. wrote a letter to Dr. Young, thanking him for his contribution to Alcoholics Anonymous through Roland Hazard, maybe. If that's not correct, somebody will correct me after, I'm sure. But I'm pretty sure that's how it happened. And so Dr. Young wrote Bill back, and you know, very happy to participate in that, and said something along, and he gave his assessment of alcoholism to Bill, and it was something along the lines of that alcoholism was a unconscious, deep unconscious craving for a spiritual experience. We just didn't know it. We knew we needed something, and we're looking for it in all different ways. In every kind of way. And I found that in the drink. I found that first spiritual experience in the drink. So it kind of makes sense why the solution to alcoholism is a spiritual program. It's a spiritual experience, right? Totally makes sense. So I had that first drink. It was everything I thought it would turn out to be. I had another magical thing happen to me for that evening. I got real relaxed because lost my virginity that evening, too. Yeah, I discovered two things that night I would chase for many years. It would get me in all kind of trouble. The booze and the ladies. So it was a good night. one to remember. And about this time in my life, I guess I was probably about 12 years old, a series of tragedies started happening. Now, up until this point, aside from my internal suffering, my outside world was great. my brother and I grew up in, you know, we weren't exposed to, we didn't know anything about politics. We didn't know war existed. We didn't know about divorce. It wasn't really a thing in our neighborhood or stuff like that. And there was some fighting going on in the house between our parents. And it was getting pretty bad. And they ended up, you know, they sat us down and told us they're getting a divorce. Blew us away. And my mom left and she moved into the city, into Tampa. And so my brother and I stayed with our father. And then I was 12, 13 years old. I started spending time at this man's house in my neighborhood. He started giving me booze, and a lot of booze, and he started sexually abusing me. And that happened quite often, weekly, sometimes biweekly, maybe once a month. And I would go over there, and because for the booze, that's why I went. And you know, I would sit there, and when he drew near to me, I would cringe, but I kept going back. Because he had the booze. So, you know, that was a obviously pretty messed up situation. And that went on for a couple years. And then just before my 15th birthday, my father had just turned 42. He died of a heart attack, unexpected. He was healthy. He ran 5 miles a day, took care of himself, you know, 42 years old, and had a heart attack, passed away. Completely unexpected. So by the age 15, my brother and I, we move out of Lutz. We move into the city with our mom, and I am completely screwed up in every kind of way in the head. I recall my father's funeral, not really understanding what was going on. I didn't grieve until like a year later. I was in some kind of a denial phase for a long time. So really messed up over that. So my brother and I, we find ourselves on the streets of Seminole Heights. And our mom, you know, she was kind of living her life. She was dating a lot, doing different things. And so my brother and I, we took to the streets. And we spent a lot of time on the streets. Now, the Seminole Heights area is a little bit different than where we grew up. When we grew up, it was pretty much out in the country. It was one type of people. It was just white people, pretty much. We moved into Seminole Heights. There was all kinds. We had Latins and blacks and whites, and then different, you know, burnouts. I was kind of a burnout then, long hair and stuff like that. And the jocks and all the different categories that we put ourselves in, right? So we had our different groups and cliques. But I kind of like to hang out with all the cliques. But what I noticed looking back later is I had a different mask for each one. I was a different guy in every crowd. And once in a while, when they all get together for a big party or something, I didn't know how to act. I don't know which guy I was. But I certainly wasn't who I really was, that's for sure. But I gotta tell you, we all were different, but the streets and our suffering, what it took us out there, brought us together. We had that common bond that brought us together. But we also had a common solution that kept us together too, and that was a bottle. That was our common solution to our pain and suffering. So spent a lot of time out on the streets, got into a lot of illegal activities. Stealing cars was my main thing. And didn't really sell them much, just drove them around and crashed them and burned them and stuff like that. It's really stupid, but that's what we did. And then I tried getting a job. Something about drinking on the job, they frowned upon that, and I just couldn't hold a job. Got arrested a lot. Got kicked out of my house and back and forth a lot. Got kicked out of school a lot. In fact, the 11th grade, I went to three different schools for the 11th grade in the same year. It was the same year. I kept getting kicked out of the school, and I'd try another one, and another one, another one. So finally, almost at the end of the year, that last school in the 11th grade, I dropped out. Dropped out of school, but while I was there, I met this girl. And she didn't drink. She was normal. I guess maybe she was normal. She didn't drink. But we were a good mix. We were a good mix because she was a caretaker and I was a mess. And I needed taken care of. And it was like I was a mess and she would clean it up. And I was a mess and she would clean it up. And she seemed to thrive off of that. She was a good person too. And I really, you know, loved her. And I say that now because she's my ex. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Really loved her, cared about her, a good person, but we were a good match in that way. So obviously I asked her to marry me. I'm like, I got to keep this one for life. And so I asked her to marry me, and she was totally cool with my drinking until about 2 weeks in, she sat me down and she said, we need to make some changes. I don't know what happened in that 2 weeks. Maybe a little Al-Anon, something. I don't know what happened, but she sat me down because she gave me choices. She said, you have 3 choices. And I'm like, okay. She said, either you got to stop drinking. I was like, next. you can leave. And I'm like, okay. Or you can go to treatment. And she handed me this pamphlet. I looked at it, and there was a spa, and they were giving massages and stuff. I'm like, okay, I'll go to treatment. So I went off to a 30-day program. 30-day program to treatment. 3 waters. I hope all these are for me, or I'm drinking somebody's water. Okay. So I went off to treatment. The care unit in Tampa, I don't know if it exists anymore. And I have to tell you, one of the best things I got out of treatment was exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous. They took me in that van, and I was one of those guys in the druggy buggy, they call it sometimes, looking out the window, slobbering on the window, rolling up to the meeting, getting out, trying to walk around the corner and come back so they wouldn't know I got off the van. I remember sitting in the meetings, and one of the first things I noticed about you all was the head bobbing. I remember, sitting in the meeting, and everybody's going like this, and I'm like, what's going on with these people? It was weird, the head bobbers. And then, but then it happened to me. About 2 weeks in, I caught myself once doing it. I'm like, oh, my, whoa, I'm one of them. But that's when I first started identifying. That was when I was kind of sliding into the step one a little bit piece. But I heard a lot, and I shared this a little bit on the panel the other night. What really, really impressed me about you guys. Now, it wasn't those of you who had 30 years or plus. I actually didn't believe it. I really could not conceive that. And especially when you shared some of your pain that you had gone in sobriety, I'm like, how is that person not drinking? How? It's just, I don't know. But that guy in the corner shaking with a cup of coffee, 30 days sober, I'm like, dude, I want to get there. That's impressive. To me. I want that. But then I heard some of you share, and I could tell, first off, from your story, identified, I could see, all right, wait, they're like me. You are really like me. And I could tell you were genuinely happy. And that sober and happy at the same time, that's what I couldn't achieve. I could be happy when I was drunk. I could be sober, but I was miserable. But at the same time, that just didn't last for very long. But I saw it. So my wife was taking me to these meetings, and she would come in, and she would sit next to me, and it was just like she was staring at me during the meeting, and we'd have to go right away, and it went on and on and on. And finally, this guy came over, and he said, ma'am, you can leave him here. We'll take care of him. It'll be okay. And she said, are you sure? And he says, yes, you can pick him up right after the meeting. She said, okay. And she left, and I looked at that guy, and I said, will you be my sponsor? That guy has skills. I've been trying to get her to leave me there for months. But really, I had already been eyeing this guy a little bit because he was a happy and sober guy at the same time. Really impressed by his sobriety, I could tell it was really sincere. So I asked him to sponsor me, and he said, yes. But I want you to give me a call when you get home. I said, okay. So I got home. I picked up the phone. I called him. It's one of those sponsor things. And he told me this really scary voice. He's like, are you willing to crawl on your hands and knees to my house right now for your sobriety? I was like, what the heck? Really? But I got to tell y'all, and I remember this because it reminds me how desperate I was. I thought about it. And I'm like, I cannot believe this is going to happen. Hopefully he'll tell me this is a joke or something, but I said, yes, I will call my hands and knees right now. And he laughed and laughed. And he said, bro, I'm glad you're willing, but we don't crawl on our hands and knees today. We walk on our feet. So meet me tomorrow night at the side room before the meeting. I was like, whew. Pass the test. But the real test was that night before the meeting when he sat me down and he looked at me and he says, okay, if I'm going to sponsor you, I have some rules. And I was like, rules? And I said, but I heard in the meeting last night, we don't have rules in AA. We just have suggestions. And he's like, no, well, these are my rules. And I was like, okay. And here's what he told me. He said, if you walk in a meeting late, you're going to sit down. You don't get to share. I was like, okay. And then he said, you will sit up in a meeting. You will always look at the person that's sharing. You will not crosstalk. And he explained what that meant. He said, you will not speak to the person next to you during the meeting. And if it's a speaker's meeting, you will get up and you will shake the hand of the speaker. You will share some of your experience that you identified with theirs, and you will thank them for speaking. You will always shake the hand of the person chairing the meeting, thank them for their service. And you will not get up, no matter what, for any reason whatsoever during a meeting, ever. Use the bathroom, get your coffee beforehand. I was like, okay. Yes. And I had no clue why I was doing any of that. But I got to tell you, the first thing I noticed is other people didn't have his rules real quick. In fact, the first one was that night when I'm sitting there and he's next to me and some guy got up to get coffee and I was like, oh. And I looked over at him and I looked back at that guy and before I could turn back, he whispers in my ear, I'm not sponsoring him. I was like, oh, wow. That guy was good. He could read my mind like that all the time. And you know, I understand today he was teaching me a lot of what I needed. He was teaching me to sit still, to pay attention, to respect other people in the meeting, to identify, to respect those doing service, not to just think about myself. He teaching me a lot. And he also was giving me an opportunity to take actions of which I had no idea why I was taking them, but I saw myself doing them. And I noticed other people weren't doing them either, and I felt kind of good about that. And he gave me a job of mopping too, right? And I was not happy about that at first. Mopping. This meeting met 7 nights a week, and everybody else is outside smoking and having fun, and I'm in there mopping the floor. But then I started taking my job seriously. And 30 days in, he came up with the other new guy and he's like, it's time for you to give your mop job up. I was like, no way. And I reluctantly gave it up, and I gave the guy instructions on how the chairs should be situated and different things, and I reported back to my sponsor for like 2 weeks on it. It wasn't a good report either. This is on this guy's work. But he had me involved right away, and in my home group, too. And I worked every service position in my home group. I got to tell you, one of my most challenging experiences with that, I was 2 years sober. My sponsor was 4 years sober. I was the chairperson of the group. He was the chair. He was the treasurer. And I didn't mention my first sponsor's name for this reason, that he stole the money. And he ran. And he relapsed. And they called an emergency business meeting. Or I called an emergency business meeting. And suddenly people, we probably had on our business meetings active maybe 10 people show up. Like 150 people showed up at this business meeting. Word got around. It was people that were members of this group for years before that hadn't been active. And they wanted prosecution. Everybody, and most of the group, we're going to prosecute him. And I'm like, oh, no. Well, we had a group inventory a couple months before that. And in fact, during this group inventory, we had made the decision that if you weren't at 3 consecutive business meetings, you can't vote. Because it wouldn't be an informed vote. People were showing up at the last minute, bringing all their friends, and they hadn't been in discussion for weeks or whatever, months, and vote on something. So thankfully, the core of that group, those who were at that business meeting, made the vote, and we had that group inventory. We were real, real keen on what our primary purpose was and what we should or shouldn't do in that situation. We voted to let it go. And I caught a lot of flack from people for a while, because he was my sponsor, and I was the chairperson of that group, and they were saying, you were just doing that because he was your sponsor, and I'm like, well, you can think whatever you want. It is what it is. There's a group conscious decision. So I stayed sober through that because he taught me to be dependent on a higher power. And Candace, like you were sharing last night, not on any person, not on him, on a higher power. So, but a little bit, to back up a little bit, So this guy, he took me through the steps. I'm not going to run through all the steps, but I will share a few that were really, really important for me. For one, the higher power thing. So And actually, I need to back up a little bit because I'm still in treatment. I jumped ahead. Yes, I'm back to treatment. All this didn't happen in treatment. The didn't work the service positions while in treatment. So back to treatment. I was in treatment. I exposed it to AA a little bit. Saw this guy. Thought about asking him to be my sponsor. This is before the wife thing. But while I was in treatment, they kept talking about we're a 12-step based program. And so I thought, well, I better look at those things. And I figured I'm going to just kind of do them right now real quick. And so I looked at them. And step one, okay, yep. All right, two, what? All right, three, whoa. What is that little word? That little big word. You guys know what that word is? It was an hour or two. How'd you know that? That God thing. And I had a real issue with the God thing. I'll tell you a little bit of why, my family dynamics. So my dad's side of the family, atheists, like believing atheists, like bumper stickers, the whole deal. They really believe, you don't believe. My mom's side of the family, Jehovah's Witnesses, like really strong. They are all about it. It was not a good mix in our family, and there was all kind of tug of war over that. I don't want to have anything to do with that word. And so I thought, well, okay, this program, if it has to do with that, it's just not going to work for me. So I continued on through treatment. And when I got to the end of my treatment, though, it was 30 days. I was kind of starting to feel good. And I thought, you know what? I think I do want to stay sober. In fact, I'm pretty sure I can stay sober. And I left treatment, and I was so sure I was going to stay sober. You could have hooked me to a lie detector and say I was telling the truth. I was convinced. So my wife took me home. She locked me in the house. She said, you're staying here for another 30 days before you even try to look for a job. And I took my keys, my car keys, and she went off to work. I was like, okay. So let's see. Day one, an untreated alcoholic at home. Hour one, I'm bored. Hour two, restless. Hour three, irritable. Hour four, I've eaten all the dank food in the house. Hour five, I'm drinking water. Hour six, I think I am going to drink. Hour seven, she's going to be home soon. Hour eight, I got to go. She took my car keys. I was a car thief. I didn't need car keys. I see a screwdriver. So I got a screwdriver, stole my car, and I was off. And I was rolling around all kind of shady areas of town that I was real familiar with and a lot of friends in that area. And I was absolutely deep in my insanity at this point. I was trying to sell my car and with a screwdriver for the ignition. And I got people like, man, are you sure this is your car? Why is there a screwdriver sticking out of the ignition? I'm like, it's my car. I'm an alcoholic. I was starting to get really angry about it. And I got to tell you, I found myself in robot mode. And what I mean by that is my little bit of exposure to AA, I had a head full of AA and a belly full of beer thing going on, meaning I could see what was happening now. And I was caught up in it. And I knew I was an alcoholic. And I was feeling very miserable inside. That eternal bottom. And my wife was at home, and she was pregnant, our first daughter. And so, I don't know what happened with my car, but I ended up going home, and I walked in the front door. My wife grabbed her purse, and she ran, terrified, and hit her purse. And I told her, I said, well, I need to go back to those drinking classes. She's like, it's AA, it's not a drinking class. And so it took me back to AA. And I already filled you in on that part, how that whole thing went with her and showing up and staying there and hooking up with my sponsor and him giving me the rules. And so anyways, fast forward back to that. So this guy took me through a few of the steps. He took me through steps two and, well, he took me through all the steps. But the ones I'm going to share with you are steps two, three, and four, and five for obvious reasons. Two and three, I really had a problem with the God thing. And I kept telling this guy, I have a problem with the God thing. He's like, no, you don't. Yeah, okay, yes, sir. The next day, I'm like, I have a problem with the God thing. No, you don't. Yes, sir. And then finally, I told him, we've got to talk about this God thing. He says, yes, we do. So I sat down, and he took the big book, and he turned it around. He slid it over to me. He pointed to a highlighted paragraph. He said, this is what you're doing. And I read it, and it's in We Agnostics. And it says, do not let any prejudice you have against certain spiritual terms deter you from asking yourself what they mean to you. And you know, the book says, it talks about all spiritual terms. That's meditation, prayer, spiritual experience, all that says we understand it. But he said, that's what you're doing, man. And he threw this old Zen saying at me. He said, do not get stuck looking at the finger pointing at the moon and miss the moon. And he said, your idea of what this God thing means, that's the finger pointing at the moon. This higher power, spiritual experience, or whatever that is, that's the moon. You've never seen it. You have no idea what it's like. And he shared Bill's story with me a bit. And he talked about how Bill was debating back and forth. Bill was a master debater. That didn't sound right. He debated a lot. Of course, he told us not to debate at some point. But he was debating back and forth, and he's like, yeah, the God thing, but, you know, I had this experience in the cathedral, but then all the world and different things like this, but this and then that and this and that. But none of that convinced him. None of that convinced me either. I had all that stuff too. But what convinced Bill was when somebody he knew, who he knew was an alcoholic just like him, showed up and was sober. And that's what you all did for me. Sitting in those meetings, when I identified and I realized I was just like you, that's what really spoke to me. And so I started to open my mind up to that a little bit. And my sponsor told me the same thing. He said, you don't have to believe, just be willing to believe. And he said, Russ, you don't have to know what it's called, if it's a he, she, or an it, that where it resides, if it's attached to any religion or any kind of thing like that. Just start to move that way and see what happens. Be willing. And you know, the 12 of 12 tells us that willingness is the key, that if we just unlock and crack open the door opens itself. I didn't have to figure it all out. In fact, the last sentence of We Agnostics tells us, as we drew near to him, he disclosed himself to us. Right? So I just had to start the journey. And man, it started to happen. It started to happen. I think I shared with you guys, 6 months sober, I walked in, he told me about the thing on my face, which was my smile, that I realized I hadn't been smiling in a long time, but then I suddenly realized that I had been smiling for about a month, so much that it hurt. And I suddenly realized that God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, and that was my spiritual awakening. So he helped me jump through that. And you know, Bill goes on to say that scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes. A new world came into view. The icy intellectual mountain from which behind I shivered melted, and I stood in the sunlight at last. Pretty drastic change. And mine wasn't necessarily like that, but over time it certainly is, because I wanted to have nothing to do with that, but I'm all about it today. All about it. And then on to step 4 and 5. You know, I did my third step on my knees in that room with people outside. And the first one I did it, I'm like, oh my God, he wants me to get on my knees? With all these people watching? And I did it reluctantly, nervous. And I look back on that now, and I know those people were probably looking in the window saying, yes, that guy's doing his third step. You know what I mean? I just didn't get that at the time, but I did it. So step 4 and 5, what was really challenging for me was the sexual abuse stuff. And he said, well, Russ, you know, you played a part in that. You did. But what we're going to look at is the part you're playing in it today. That's what we're going to look at. And he shared this. He was brilliant. Probably God inspired, I'm sure. But he shared this story with me. He said, you know, he said, nobody's ever died of a snake bite. And I was like, well, I'm pretty sure people have died of a snake bite. And he said, no, nobody's ever died of the bite. It's the venom that eventually reaches the heart, pumps to the vein and reaches the heart. And he said, Russ, you were bit. And you've probably been bit a lot. And a lot of us have been bit. But it's that venom that kills us. And he said, bro, that part's on you. And I was kind of pissed, quite frankly. And I threw a couple of F words at him, and he threw an F word back at me, which was forgiveness. And he said, you know, forgiveness. It was a little better with his language. He said, you know, forgiveness isn't about letting him off the hook. It's about letting you off the hook, man. This is about your life today and moving forward. And so, you know, I started to look at that. And it was a great realization to realize that the paintbrush that had been painting my nightmare all these years was in my hands. And, you know, at first, I don't know about you guys, but that was painful for me. I'm like, what the hell? For all my stuff, little guilt, shame, what? Me, my part? But wait a minute. Wait, I'm holding the paintbrush. Wait a minute. I can start painting what I want. Very empowering to take responsibility for our part. Empowering me to ask God in, because that's where the real work happens. So I got to tell you, when I got to the end of my fifth step, by the way, that wasn't on my fourth step. I got to the end of my fifth step, and my sponsor said, it's been great, did a lot of great stuff. We worked through it in 2 days. It's some really intense work. And that guy fell asleep a couple of times during my fifth step. He's like, oh. I'm like, really, dude? Is my story that boring? He's like, I've been there. That's all 100 million times. But but he got to the end. He says, Russ, that's been great, but I want to hear that thing you're taking to your grave. You think you're taking to your grave. And right then my mind said, because I had been thinking about telling him, my mind said, I think I'm going to tell him. And I told him. He was the first person I told. Man, that saved my butt, my life. And I've shared that so many times openly. I'm free of it because of you guys, the steps, Alcoholics Anonymous. And so he helped me through that hoop and on through the steps. I had my spiritual awakening, very involved in service work. And started doing really well. I went back to school, got my GED, started doing other stuff. I started to realize I could do anything, man. I could do anything. With the higher power behind me and the support of a fellowship, I can do anything. I remember one day thinking, what could I do if I could do anything I wanted to do? What would it be? I want to fly airplanes. That's what I want to do. And I did it. I went to flight school, and I got my pilot's license and started flying. And now, yeah, it was awesome. And then I'm kind of an adrenaline junkie and took aerobatics. So I fly airplanes upside down, too. And I've done a lot of that. Almost died a few times, but it's been fun. So but really started doing, because of this fellowship and a higher power, getting into a lot of that stuff and doing these things and helping and supporting other people and really involved in service work. And then at some point I started to realize, man, I'm doing pretty darn good. Look at me, Russ, doing great. I don't even need as many meetings. I'm going to start hanging out, flying more, hanging out with my friends at work and different. In fact, the people I'm sponsoring, they're doing so good because I'm sponsoring them. That's why they're doing so good. And they, in fact, they probably don't even need me anymore. And, oh, my God, ego, EGO, edging God out. And that's exactly what I did. Ridiculous. And I kind of went through the steps in reverse. I don't know if you guys ever heard that, but it's exactly what happened. The steps happen. They roll recovery up into a nice little package that we can keep giving away, right? And I unraveled that thing. I popped the bow at first by step 12, and because it wasn't about helping people anymore. Now it was about me again. Step 11, I stopped plugging into God. And this is the steps in reverse, by the way. Step 10, I'm not looking at myself anymore. 8 and 9, why do I make amends to you? You're the problem. 6 and 7, your character defects were glaring. 4 and 5, by this point, I'm suffering, but I am not telling anybody because I'm Mr. A, right? I'm not sharing that with anybody. Step 3, I turned my will and my life back over the care of Russ, which I had pretty much done back there somewhere. Really, honestly. And then step 2, the scales tipped back. More belief in myself, less belief in a higher power. Step 1, I think I can have one. And this is October 2000. I was celebrating 7 years sober, and I went out with some people from work. They took me out to celebrate my 7 years sober, and they bought me a beer. Yep. And so it all fell apart. I had something about seven. Was sober 7 years, married 7 years, and I went back out for 7 years. Now, the married for only 7 years probably had the fact that I was sober 7 years, because when I went back out, my marriage didn't last. And I got to tell y'all, so my life had improved a lot by recovery. But when I went back out, my problems improved as a result. Before I was getting misdemeanors, I was losing jobs, I was hurting myself, I was crashing cars. Now I had a wife and 2 daughters I was hurting. I was getting felonies. I was crashing airplanes, crashed 2 airplanes drunk. So the odds went up. The results went up a little bit, negative way. And those 7 years were absolutely insane. Insane. During that time, I inherited a ton of money, more than I should have had. quite a bit, close to seven figures, and it was gone in a year. And I had just one little car to show for it. Yeah, I was partying my butt off, so it was a mess. And really hurt a lot of people, disappointed a lot of people, really hurt myself. So I ended up somehow, I met another normal girl, though. She didn't drink. Now get this, I asked her once to drink, and she said, I don't like to drink because it makes me dizzy. I was like, dizzy's good. But she said, no, it makes me feel out of control. I was like, what? Oh, that's how I feel when I don't drink. I felt in control when I drank, suave. Until a little ways in, and I was out of control, but I kind of enjoyed that a little bit. But she was not the caretaker. She was the fixer. She was going to fix me. And so I asked her to marry me, and she said, now, during this time, my ex-wife had moved my daughters to Pennsylvania. Now, a little bit of geography here. For those who aren't familiar with the states, maybe you know, I don't know. But I lived in South Florida, very warm most of the time. Pennsylvania's cold. It's very, very cold up there, cold I had never experienced. And so my new wife told me, we are moving to Pennsylvania so you can be near your kids and get sober. And I was like, okay, let's do it. So we left, we shipped all our stuff up and we left, and I had never been any further north than Atlanta, Georgia. It was late November, and we're driving. I think I had sandals on, my usual attire, sandals, shorts, and a t-shirt. And we're cruising up there, and we got out somewhere in northern Maryland, close to Pennsylvania. And I got up to pump gas, and I was like, what the hell? My body just felt, it was cold. And I had already been noticing that everything was dead. The trees were dead, and it was dark. And I'm like, where's she taking me? And so I got out, and I'm sitting there, and I'm pumping gas. And I look over, and I see the guy next to me pumping gas. He has Pennsylvania plates. And I'm like, oh, hey, man, that's funny. So funny. I'm from Florida. I'm moving to Pennsylvania. And he laughed. He said, we're from Pennsylvania. We're moving to Florida. And they laughed. And they laughed really hard. And I was like, what are they laughing about? And I got in and told my wife. She's like, yeah, I don't know. And so she was born and raised in Florida. She's Spaniard, Cuban, and Irish, very interesting mix. But I spent most of her time, down in South Florida as well. So we got to Pennsylvania, and I was in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, one bar town, which is a real mistake. If your wife knows where to find you. She always knew where to find me. I was in that bar, and it was ridiculous. I would be really drunk coming home. I could still do a 10-step while I'm drunk and talking all kind of craziness to her. And she kept saying, you got to go back to AA. So I decided I was going to go to a meeting in Pennsylvania, and I saw there was one at this church, and so I went to this church, and I'm wandering around looking for a while, and there's nobody in the church. Where are they? I'm sure it's here. Finally, this guy found me, and he's like, oh, you here for the meeting? Yeah. And he, it's over here. And it took him down. It was in the ground, because we don't have basements in Florida. So I was like, what is this? They got rooms in the ground. So... And I found out that's where they keep the drunks up there, is down in, most of those meetings were down in the ground. So I went down in there, and I sat in this meeting. I was there about 5 minutes, and I realized they didn't do AA right, and it's in Pennsylvania. They didn't read the right stuff. I didn't like the way they talked. The meeting was conducted backwards, and they were passing, it was kind of a farmer town. They had spenders on. They were passing plates of deer jerky around. I'm like, what the heck is this? They're all kind of weird. They have Bibles on the table, which kind of threw me off a little bit. I'm like, that's not right. And so I left. I'm like, they don't do it right here. This isn't going to work. So I left and went to the bar that night. I was really, really super wasted and decided I need to head down to Baltimore to get some of that stuff that helps me drink all night long. So I left. And I was on my way down and driving really fast in my cute little sports car and lost control of my car and ran off the road and slammed into the side of a church. And broke my leg, my femur, and a bunch of other bones and taken off to the hospital. That was the last time I drank. My last drink that night at that bar. I didn't know it was going to be. And, it's funny sometimes when I'm celebrating my sobriety and I talked to my wife about it. She's like, yeah, it's funny, you're celebrating. That wasn't a happy memory for me. Great memory for you, not a happy memory for me. That's when I got that call. You're at the hospital. So I spent 3 nights at the hospital while they rearranged my bones and begging them, please don't take my blood. I don't want a DUI. And they're like, dude, your blood's everywhere. But and I ended up getting a DUI. I blew something really high. And so 3 days at the hospital, came back, and I thought, I need to go back to that meeting. So I crutched down the stairs about 4 days later. My crutches, little Band-Aids all over me. And they're sitting back, uh-huh, we've been waiting for you. Their suspenders. Sat down in that meeting, and the meeting started, and had my cup of coffee. And I don't know if they had a group conscience meeting and made some changes while I was gone, but their meetings got better. It was right on, man. They were reading just the right stuff, saying just the right things. Exactly what I needed. And obviously, their AA was as perfect as it needed to be the whole time. I just needed a brick wall on the side of a church to wake me up. The deer jerky was excellent, by the way. I just blended right in with it. And I had this thing while I was there. I kept raising my hand saying, yeah, I'm new, but I had 7 years. Any new people? Yes, but I had 7 years. And that went on for like a couple of weeks. So finally, this guy came up. And he says, hey, man, come here for a second. He says, I've got some advice for you. You don't have 7 years. and you probably want to let that go. And he tricked my ego, too, because here's what he told me. He says, look, can you do this? Can you just pretend? Just pretend like you don't know anything. Just pretend like you don't know anything. Pretend like you don't know anything in that book. Can you pretend like you're new? And I was like, I said, yeah, I can pretend like I'm new. And he says, okay. And so, but I got to tell you, I started doing it because I was new. And I sat there, but I started telling myself, all right, Russ, you're new, man. Just pretend like you don't know anything. Just hear with new ears. Hear with new ears. And I'd be darned if I didn't start hearing new stuff and the same stuff in a different way. And somebody would come up to me and say, I heard what you shared. Go home and read. And I knew what they were going to say. And I'd just say, okay, well, thank you. And I would go home, and I knew what it was going to say, and I read it, but it changed. Wow. Constantly changing. And so, and ISA got to be my sponsor up there, Ed Knockle in Hanover, Pennsylvania area. And he took me through the steps, Baltimore style, a little bit different, through the book, though, and really great guy. So got really involved in recovery up there. I got to tell you, I attended a group up there. I was trying to find my home group. I attended a group. I didn't like some things they did. I went back to my sponsor, and I said, I didn't get anything out of that meeting. And he said, what'd you say? I said, I didn't get anything out of that meeting. And he says, oh, you didn't get anything out of the meeting. He says, you selfish son of a gun. Did you take anything to the meeting? Did you bring anything to the meeting? I was like, and he said, besides your judgment. I was like, no, but I definitely brought that. And so he said, I want you to go back and see what you can bring to that meeting. And he gave me a time limit to be there. And I went back, and I'll be darned how things started to change. And I ended up making that meeting my home group. Go figure, right? The guidance of a sponsor and an open mind. So enjoyed my time in sobriety there in Pennsylvania. Still didn't like the cold. I always wanted to go home to Florida. Saw my daughters. I got to tell you all real quick, my amends to my daughters. Now, I had sat down with my daughters plenty of times and sat in front of them and said, I'm sorry for what happened. And things are going to be different. Okay, Dad. And it wasn't any different this time, you know, except I said things a little differently. I apologize. And is there any way I can make this up to you? And what do you want to see from me? And then I told them, but I'm here to show you. That's why I'm here. I'm here to show you. And they still gave me that same nod. But I got to tell you, I saw my daughters through high school. And my oldest daughter, when she graduated from high school, she came home with her paper, her high school paper, with a big A-plus on the top. And I read the paper, and it was our town drunk. And I was like, oh, okay. And I started reading. I'm like, oh, no. It was about her dad. But I started reading it, And she was talking about how all the things I taught her not to do, and what a great demonstration that was for her in lessons. And then she started, I get a little choked up here, she started talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, she came to meetings with me coloring during the meetings. Years of meetings sitting next to me coloring. And Alcoholics Anonymous, and how Alcoholics Anonymous gave her dad back. And how now today I'm a teacher for her what to do. And I was crying when I looked up from that paper, and she was crying too. And that's when I knew the amends was underway. That's when I knew. So that was a powerful experience for me. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous, man, and higher power in the steps. So I saw them through high school, and my daughters went off to college. Amazing. My oldest daughter is a school teacher now in Maryland. My middle daughter, because I have three now, my new wife, I have a daughter. My middle daughter just graduated Penn State. She's looking to go on to probably a medical school. She's kind of weighing that a little bit. And my youngest daughter's 12. And boy, she's a something. I got to keep my eye on her, a little worried. But some of those tendencies, but she's great. She's incredible. She rides horses. She plays tennis. She does yoga. She does gymnastics, and she plays the trumpet. 12 years old, pretty amazing kid. Takes after a mom, I think, a little bit. Must. And my wife and I have an absolutely unbelievable marriage. I read a card. She left. She said, "Don't open until before you speak." And I opened it up, and how much she supports me, and she's here with me, and leave it to God, and stuff like that. And just such a beautiful card that she left. So 6 minutes here. All right. So I came back. My wife and I moved back. We moved back to Tampa. My daughters were off to other states. We came back. I jumped right into a meeting, got back involved into service work. And recently, as mentioned, after a few years back in Tampa, I moved further south because I love warm weather. I might even keep going. Maybe I'll come here eventually. Tampa was still a little too cold for me, so I moved further south and seeking a home group down there. Got really involved down there already a little bit. And I'd like to share just a little bit here on the end with a few things. The pandemic. Now, I got to tell you guys, when that thing first started and we had to stay home and stuff, and I work from home anyways. I do personal development work over the phone, working with people, such a gift that this program has given me. Getting paid for that stuff, not AA stuff, that's separate, personal development. But and so I was kind of excited. I was kind of secretly excited. Oh, this is kind of exciting. And so about 6 months in, I'm like, this is not cool. What is going on? We can't go to meetings and stuff either. And so I started getting that little restless, irritable, discontent thing started coming back. And I talked to my sponsor, and here's what he told me. He said, Russ, you're going to get to the end of this at some point. You're going to look back, and you're going to remember how you showed up. And your kids are going to remember how you showed up, and your sponsors are going to remember how you showed up, and you're going to remember how you showed up. And you're not going to be able to change it then. And discipline yourself now. Discipline weighs ounces. Regret weighs tons. You don't want to look back and say, I lost my crap. And he was brilliant in that way because it kept me in check every day. It's like, I want to show up at my best. This is an opportunity. Like Candace had mentioned, you know, that part from the book, when trouble comes, we cheerfully capitalize it. Tells us the state. We cheerfully capitalize it as an opportunity to demonstrate his omnipotence. And boy, this was a Serenity Prayer boot camp, wasn't it? Serenity Prayer boot camp. And the opportunity was there. And so I learned a great lesson in that. And then I end with this. There's a part in the book. I love it. I love all the parts in the book, actually. On page 4, the newer edition, 417, the acceptance piece. But one page over, a couple pages over, 419, where he talks about, the author talks about our focus, what we focus on. And it talks about in a meeting, this lesson I learned, my sponsor taught me, what we focus on in a meeting or anywhere in life where we're focused on the negative or the positive. And any situation has it. I could sit in this room right now and get really unhappy by finding things that are wrong with me or the situation or the room or anything. Or I could feel really great by taking the time and noticing everything that's great about this room. And the room doesn't change. It's what I'm focused on And every situation has both available to us. And the book calls it, the author of this story called it the magic magnifying mind. The magic magnifying mind. And that magic magnifying mind is always on. Always on. So I got to be careful what I focus on, because this is going to be magnified. And what I find to choose on to, choose to focus on today is gratitude. I heard a long time ago that a grateful alcoholic does not get drunk. And I found that to be true. And I'm going to leave you guys with this technique that I learned. The technique was, I called the appreciation walk. So I was working in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Anybody ever been there? Ugly as heck. I know. It's beautiful, but it was during the winter, and I wasn't a big fan of the winter time. So, and I was working, somebody mentioned attorneys at this thing, right? I think, I was working for attorneys, a little challenging, and I was in sobriety, a couple years sober. And I left, I bolted out of there, I was pissed off, and I went walking down the street. I was really angry, and I decided, let me try this appreciation walk thing. And it kind of goes like this. You go outside, and you take a walk, and you just say thank you for everything. Everything you can think of in that moment. Thank you for that heartbeat. Thank you for that breath. Thank you for that sound I hear. And not the judgment. Judge it. It could be a sound of a car or a sound of a bird chirping, just that I can hear. Thank you for that sound. Thank you for that other breath. Thank you for the blue sky. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. In about 15, 20 minutes, with a magnifying mind on that, you can't go wrong. I walked back in. I had the biggest grin on my face. I'm pretty sure people that didn't know I was a recovery thought I smoked a joint or something. Because gratitude will do that for you. I came back in. So if you ever find yourself in a tight bind, focus on the wrong thing, gratitude always seems to work great for me. So thank you for this great opportunity to share with everybody. Thank you.